Just a friendly warning, this interview contains sensitive material. The headline in the New York Times proclaims her the smutty metaphor queen of Lawrence, Kansas. She has more than 30,000 followers on Twitter. She may not be what you expect of a celebrity poet, and that's not just because that phrase, celebrity poet, is an oxymoron to begin with. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today I'm very happy to be speaking with Patricia Lockwood of Lawrence, Kansas. Hi, Patricia. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. That music was insane. I felt like we were at a house party or like a rave, perhaps, in Europe in 1998.
If you were going to write a poem about that song, what do you think it might be titled?
Techno Princess.
Ooh, I like it.
That's just off the top of my head. I can come up with something better, and I'll tell you at the end, okay?
Okay, I like that idea.
All right, good.
How do you feel about having been crowned the smutty metaphor queen? It's a nice title.
I think, yeah, because it was a pun, because, you know, he was calling back to the piece I read at the Brooklyn reading, which was the Queens of Hyatt Place, which I wasn't allowed to say in the New York Times, so we had to, you know, work around that a little bit. And so it was really a callback to that. I felt it was appropriate.
Do you think that kind of working around the sort of boundary pushing nature of your work is something that is going to be a challenge for you as you become, you're becoming very well known very quickly?
That's true. I think the fact that I have no boundaries is really helping me here. So if I do eventually get to a point where I need to exist within them, then I don't know what I'm going to do. But as long as they let me do whatever I want, I think that I will be okay.
I think that being able to do whatever you want sounds really nice.
Yeah, it's lawless. It's American. It's the frontier mentality.
I like it. Well, how would you explain what it means to be a smutty metaphor queen?
Oh, boy. It means that you just say the first thing that comes to your head at any given moment, and that occasionally extends to writing things down. So anything that anyone else would censor mentally that they wouldn't allow to cross the bridge between their brain and their mouth, you just let it all go. You just say whatever you want at any given time.
When did you start doing this?
The smuttiness?
Just being uncensored.
That was my whole life. That's when I was born, and I came out screaming very bad obscenities that had not yet been transliterated into words.
Hmm. Can you teach them to me later?
Yes. Yes. During Techno Princess, okay. I will help you out with that.
Well, in addition to publishing poems in the format of books, you've written poetry using Twitter, but you're calling those poems sects, not poems. Could you talk about your sects? I'd like very quickly to note that that's not a request I ever expected to make during a radio interview.
Tell me about your sex. I can sext you. I mean, I sext the whole world this way. This came about when I first joined Twitter. And I think that part of the creativity of Twitter is when you first join up to a new service like that and you're not really sure how it works and not a lot of people are looking at you, you can really do anything. So I didn't have that many followers at this time. So I felt no sense of what I should say or what I shouldn't say or, you know, what people might pay attention to or what might be appropriate. So this was when the Anthony Penis scandal was going on, and I was thinking a lot about it, and I was thinking about all of the crazy, like, scare trends, you know, in the media where they were like, teens sexting online at night, pictures of themselves, can we believe it? And they were so freaked out. And I thought, well, let's do this. Let's sext the whole world, but let's shift the vocabulary a little bit. So it's not actually, these aren't actually sex, but I'm talking about animals, and I'm talking about clouds. And it's sort of really calls into the spotlight the ridiculousness of something like sexting or the language that we use for, like, sexy talk when you sort of transpose it into a slightly different, more surreal key.
What catches your attention about what it means, how people use language when they're trying to talk sexy?
It's very ridiculous. I think that we have all seen how ridiculous humans can be when they're like, oh, yeah, Yes, my body part, now your body part. Now we do things to the body parts together. It's obviously ridiculous. So let's think about, what if they're not body parts? What if they're tentacles? What if we don't have forms? You know, what if we're in the sky made of, you know, air masses, that kind of thing? What if I'm a mountain? What if I'm Mount Rushmore? What if you want to get it on with Mount Rushmore? You just let it go. You let it snowball. You do what you want.
Well, what do you think the format of Twitter might free you up to do that the format of a book might not?
The constraints are really, really interesting. When I first started, I was using a kind of baby language because you had to cut out a lot of words and you had to spell things in baby ways.
Because on Twitter, you have 140
characters. 140 characters, so you don't have all the room in the world, which you do in a poem. I mean, obviously, no one wants to read like a 400-page long poem, Dante. But when it comes to Twitter, you actually are squeezed into this tiny little box. And that can be really fun for people who are used to editing themselves, to condensing. Obviously, that's a skill that you use in poetry.
One of your poems that's gotten a lot of attention is a poem called Rape Joke. Would you mind reading a small portion of that poem for us so everyone has a frame of reference as we discuss it?
Absolutely. Rape joke. The rape joke is that you were 19 years old. The rape joke is that he was your boyfriend. The rape joke, it wore a goatee. A goatee. Imagine the rape joke looking in the mirror, perfectly reflecting back itself, and grooming itself to look more like a rape joke. Ah, it thinks. Yes, a goatee. No offense. The rape joke is that he was 7 years older. The rape joke is that you had known him for years, since you were too young to be interesting to him. You liked that use of the word interesting, as if you were a piece of knowledge that someone could be desperate to acquire, to assimilate, and to spit back out in different form through his goateed mouth. Then suddenly you were older, but not very old at all. The rape joke is that you had been drinking wine coolers. Wine coolers? Who drinks wine coolers? People who get raped, according to the rape joke. The rape joke is he was a bouncer and kept people out for a living. Not you. The rape joke is that he carried a knife and would show it to you and would turn it over and over in his hands as if it were a book. He wasn't threatening you, you understood. He just really liked his knife.
So that poem goes on for quite a while after that.
A long time after that, yes.
It's a pretty intense poem, and yet in response to this poem, The Guardian has said that you, quote, may well be the first person with an actual sense of humor to write an attack on rape jokes. Or is it actually a defense of rape jokes? So what would you say you were going for with that poem?
I think, you know, when people talk about what were you trying to do in a poem, I always, that's a silly question because it makes it sound as if, you know, your hands were tied behind your back and you were trying to say something and the only way you could do it was a poem. That's not really how poetry works. But I was trying to capture sort of the ambiguities and the tensions. I thought that it would be interesting to see if I could write the poem as honestly and as forthrightly as I could and have it be true and also have it be possibly funny. I didn't know if that was something that I could do, so I set it as sort of a challenge, I think. I wanted to know if it were possible.
That question that The Guardian asks about whether it's an attack on the rape joke or a defense of rape jokes, is it important for you for your readers to know the answer to that question?
Not at freaking all. No. Again, not how poems work. They're objects. You take them as objects. You exist inside them. You sort of exist inside their thought process. They're not attacks or defenses of anything. That's not how good poems work.
That is a really interesting subject because I think in our current culture, maybe people's familiarity with poetry is something that's from grade school or something.
Definitely, where you tie the poem to the chair and torture a confession out of it. Now, I think, honestly, part of the reason people do abandon it is because of that approach that we take with teaching. And it goes back to what I was saying before, where we ask people, what is the poet trying to say? Well, they're trying to say the poem, and they just did. So go F yourself. I mean, it's fair, you know, it's a fundamental misunderstanding, I think.
Well, what is a poem, if not something that is an attack or a defense or something that could have been said in some other way, but was said in this other sneaky way.
Right. I think that's the idea. Like, if I wanted to say it in a different way, then I would have. A poem is something else. It's a machine made out of words. It's something that you can only say in this particular way.
A machine of ambiguity. Is that what you said?
I said a machine made out of words, which is a quote.
A machine made out of words.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about ambiguity.
It could run on ambiguity as it's like gasoline or oil. I don't know how machines work at all.
But ambiguity seems to be a piece of this equation.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What is the relationship between ambiguity and poetry, do you think?
Ambiguity can actually be captured in poetry, I think, in a way that it can't in other media. So if you write an essay and you don't have a thesis and you don't come to a conclusion, then you've written really a terrible essay. It's not going to be very good. But a poem doesn't work like that. A poem can not make a statement of the sort that people want it to make and still be a poem and still be successful.
And yet rape itself is a very strong, very unambiguous thing with very little gray area around it from a moral perspective. It's part of a really volatile conversation in our culture right now. How do you tap into that kind of linguistic playfulness, exploration of a subject in that kind of environment?
Well, it's something that I do in my other poetry. So it wasn't as if I just sat down for the first time to write rape joke and that came out. So I'd been trained for it by writing that way with other things. But I was really interested in the concept. Even the sound of it, it has such a hard sound, rape joke. It sounds brutal. It actually does. And so repeating it again and again, it was interesting sonically. It was interesting in all of its implications. You know, you're not necessarily thinking about how do I attack this? How do I approach it? The challenge for the poem is just to get itself written. So it's talking to you. It's not thinking about how people are going to receive it or about what you should be trying to do. Or even if you should be correct or politically correct as you talk about it, it's just thinking about getting itself out of you.
In the process of going from working on the poem to getting ready to present it kind of publicly and usher it out into the world.
Yeah.
Do you ever have moments where thoughts that you hadn't been having along the way, thoughts about things like political correctness and how people will receive it start creeping in and where you have to have a different kind of conversation with yourself?
Not particularly. That's not really the way I work. Although I will say, obviously, when you publish a poem, you're not expecting like 1 billion people in the world to read it. So I wasn't, I certainly wasn't expecting the reach that it had. So I had sent it into The All, and I heard back from Mark Bibbins right away. He said, we'd love to publish this. And then, of course, you know, a poem doesn't get published for about 6 months or, you know, to a year sometimes. So I'd really just kind of let it fall to the back of my mind. And then it came out, and then came the huge incoming wave of attention.
How have you been receiving all of this attention? It's a lot of poets probably don't expect to ever receive the amount of attention you've received.
There's no attention for poets, no.
But you are a notable exception.
Well, it is interesting. It helps that I'm just sort of a completely oblivious, possibly even delusional person. So you can kind of put yourself in a rubber room and not listen to all the things. Like, don't Google yourself. You don't need to read comments. You don't need to read every think piece that people write about what you write. You can insulate yourself to a certain degree. I think it's important to do that in order to keep on working without taking too much to heart people's expectations of you, what they want you to be writing in the future, what they feel that you should be doing. It's important to have that self-protective instinct.
One of your books made it on the best of 2013 list in The New Yorker for poetry, and that's a pretty big moment for a poet. How did you respond when you found out you had made that list? What was that like?
Well, I think actually that was Sacha Frere Jones, right? He's my boy. So it was very sweet of him to do that. He's been a huge supporter from the beginning. Actually, he was one of the first people on Twitter to notice sexts and to tell people that they should be paying attention to that. So he's been kind of a champion along the way. So it was less, it was more expected because I did know him and I know that he had been championing my work. And it wasn't as maybe out of nowhere as it might have been if it had just been like some rando guy.
But then a few months later, you're being profiled by the New York Times. And again,
that's
you have...
pretty nice. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that came out of that was a project where it was almost like a crowdsourced poem that you crafted.
Yes.
Can you talk about that experience?
Live Nude Dads.
Yes.
Now, this was really interesting because they asked me, they said, when we profiled Kate Atkinson, I believe it was, we did a story on Twitter and, you know, people tweeted lines of the story and she retweeted them. And at first I thought, I don't want to do this. I do not want to do this at all. I was trying to think of some other thing I could do. But then I thought, well, is there a way to subvert it? Is there a way that we can maybe poke fun at the task itself? Is there a way that we can have it be more in keeping with my voice and the sort of thing that I do? And so I thought, Live Nude Dads is the way.
Well, we have printed up the resulting poem.
Nice.
That you built out of people's use of the hashtag to tweet single lines that you could use in creating this thing.
Mm-hmm.
So will this be the first time you've read Live Nude Dads?
This is the first time that I've read Live Nude Dads. Yes, I'm going to start performing this one at readings because I think that it's going to go off well. I think this is going to be huge.
We'll give it a try here first.
Live Nude Dads read the Sunday paper. Live nude dads spread the paper wide. Their hearts beat hard. Their blood is red. What is black? What is white? What is nude? What is right? Live nude dads read about the Ukraine, thinking about their unmown lawns. Obituaries brush their hairy thighs. They sit the world upon their laps and ask it how its day was. Hope is the thing with fathers. The wounded news calls out promiscuous. It calls out for a dad. Live nude dads have a job to do. What will it be today? What are the stars? What is the moon? Is there a difference between storm and monsoon? India should have sandbags, thinks dad. They puzzle over the crossword where the pen is mightier. The perspective of fatherhood forces them to question whether Hagar was indeed horrible. Garfield has done something funny. Again. The dads merely glance at the weather prediction. They have their own true north. Nude dad checks his horoscope. Best not to reveal too much today. The profiles gaze also into them. In the morning, nude dads come and go. And speak of Daniel Carcillo. A few quick folds, then smooth the edges. This paper can become a boat. This is not, says one, the world I subscribe to when I put you in your mother. He's the one who hasn't read a word. I lost and give up. How do you write a poem? Okay, bye, I tried. Live nude dads read the New York Times.
So that was Live Nude Dads. Can you sort of recap for people who might have just tuned in how that poem was created?
Yes, it was on Twitter. I tweeted the title and the first line. We used the hashtag NYT poem, and we also used the hashtag Live Nude Dads because you want to cover all the bases. And then people tweeted subsequent lines to me, and I retweeted the best of those, or in my case, really the ones that fit most into the rhythmic pattern that I had set at the beginning.
Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between humor and poetry? Because there is a subtle humor there. The least subtle that the humor gets is the title itself.
Right.
And then the humor becomes more subtle. But I don't think people necessarily think of poetry as a place where humor lives. And in fact, I think that's part of the question that people keep asking, like, are you a comedian or a poet? The idea that those two things should be separate.
A person who knows how to tell a joke well is probably also a person who can write a poem. What's different is the vocabulary. So in a poem, you're talking about trees and mountains and the wind. And in a joke, you're talking about boobs and dongs and farts. So I would say the pattern, the structure, they're very much the same. They come to a punchline at the end, even. But what's different is sort of the mode. It's the nuance. It's the voice.
When I was in a college writing class and wrote a poem where the teacher sort of gave me a hard time, claiming that I was hiding behind humor.
Ooh, and bad teacher. Very bad.
But this idea that poetry is somehow supposed to be confessional and tortured and come out in a confessional and tortured way.
Yeah, that's nuts.
Is
Do what you want. No.
Is that
bad.
Something you bump up against, though?
Oh, no. Well, and part of the reason that I don't is because I never obviously had a higher education. So I didn't sit in that class, you know, where people are in a circle passing around each other's poems, and there might be a strong personality at the head of the class in the form of the teacher, and you're writing maybe toward that person's expectations or toward the expectations of other talented people in the class. There are, I think, subtle influences upon students that are exerted in that kind of environment. But that never happened to me.
Yeah. Tell us about your educational background.
There's none.
There's none.
There isn't one.
At some point you went to school.
I barely have a GED. I graduated high school. I was headed off to college. I was going to go to St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland. And then due to financial reasons, I just couldn't go. So I sort of took it upon myself to educate. To read the things that I thought were interesting, to follow particular threads down rabbit holes, you know, where I felt them to be leading me forward, as opposed to signing on to a curriculum. So it was a little bit different in that sense.
Well, we will be getting back to this conversation with Patricia Lockwood shortly, and we'll be looking forward to hearing more about her background as a poet. Central Standard will be back after this short break. I'm Gina Kaufman. Remember our friendly warning from the beginning of the hour. This interview still contains sensitive material. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Patricia Lockwood, who has recently been named by the New York Times the Smutty Metaphor Queen of Lawrence, Kansas. We've just been talking about her maybe slightly unconventional route toward poetry stardom, and we're now going to kind of resume that conversation. Patricia, where did you grow up?
I was born in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which I've never been back to. I think it's very industrial, so maybe some of that smoke got inside me and made me different. And then I was, for a while, growing up near the ocean on the eastern shore of Virginia. Then we moved back to the Midwest, and it was mostly Cincinnati, St. Louis. We moved probably 30 times before I was, like, 10 years old.
Why so much moving?
Well, first, my father was a sailor, which is where I get my mouth from. And so obviously you're moving around a lot in a military sense. And then he became a priest and you can sort of, you know, go back and forth to different dioceses.
Okay, hold up.
Oh,
there.
Yeah, that's a little bit. Okay. All right, bring it.
Yeah, so someone going from sailor to priest, that's not
it's a not
thing
a
you hear a lot.
It's not a typical route. No, it's not. No, well, he was in the Navy. He was on a nuclear submarine. He was an atheist at that point. And as I say in my profile in the New York Times Magazine, there was one, you know, they were out on one tour and they had these reel-to-reel movies and they would only have like one movie, you know, on board the submarine. And that movie happened to be The Exorcist, which the sailors watch, they watched 72 times over the course of that tour. Then on the next tour, he had a conversion experience and I challenge you to wonder, excuse me, why? Probably because of the devil movie that you watch so many freaking times. So then he came back and he was like, oh, I'm a Christian now. My mom was like, good, because you were really bad before and you were just a terrible man. So now you're going to be a good guy. He was like, yeah, I think I'll be a Lutheran. So he figures all that out. He becomes a Lutheran minister. And then he's like, hold up. This is not, you know, extreme enough for me. I want more of that big guy on the cross. I'm going to become a Catholic. And when that happens, when you have a married minister of one faith who converts to Catholicism, you can get a special dispensation from Rome, which he did.
Wait, that's real?
It's very real, yeah, to become a married Catholic priest. Yeah, so there, I mean, I think at the time that I was growing up, there were maybe 50, 200 in the United States. They didn't receive a whole lot of publicity, but they were certainly out there. It's very unusual, though.
And so you moved around a bit. When your dad was a sailor, did the moving continue after he became a Catholic priest?
Yes, ma'am, it did. It was mostly shuffling back and forth between Cincinnati and St. Louis, but he's based in Kansas City now.
How did that affect the education picture that you were describing before?
Well, it's really interesting because that meant that I went to probably, you know, like 10 different schools. Occasionally, I would leave and go back to a school I had previously been to. So it affected the way you made friends, but it also affected the way you saw your subjects, because some schools were really advanced. I went to some really great schools. Then I went to some very backward ones. So I think I would have been better at algebra if it had not happened this way. But as it is, I don't. It's terrifying. I can't solve for X for crap. I can't do any of that. I think that's part of the reason why.
Well, yet you don't seem to have missed out on a lot of language development.
No, because luckily you get to read on your own. I mean, you can do math problems on your own, but I don't think it's as common.
The results might not be as favorable.
Not be the same, yeah. But you can definitely read as many books as you want in your own free time. That's not something that's structured by school, so.
And I've read that you say you grew up and you've lived in all the worst cities in the Midwest.
That's just sort of poking affectionate fun. Obviously, like, I'm a Midwest girl at heart. I'm made out of corn. I'm made out of pigs. I'm made out of cows. We're tall because of dairy and the aforementioned crops that I was speaking of. You know, when I poke fun at the Midwest, it really is because I'm very much like a Heartland child.
The way that you can make fun of your own family.
Exactly. Don't everyone else do it. Well, other people, you can make fun of the corn part, too, because there's really so much corn.
But speaking of the Midwest, how do you like living in Lawrence? And describe for us a little bit of your life there.
Lawrence is cool. When I first told my parents that we were moving to Lawrence, my dad is like, you know, they call that little Moscow. And I was like, good, full communism. I can't wait. So I really enjoy it. I haven't lived there that long, but it is a very cool liberal town. So
what brought you to Lawrence?
My husband works for the paper there, the Lawrence Journal World.
And how did you originally get into poetry?
You know, it's so far back that it's very difficult to remember. I can recall reading these books about child writers. You probably read some of them when you were a kid as well, and thinking, yeah, that sort of self-conception is for me. I really identify with this. But most kids are creative. Most kids do write things down, write stories and poems and that sort of things. The difference is that some people continue.
What do you think prompted you to continue in a way that some people might not?
Probably obsessiveness, obsessive compulsive disorder. All of those things would factor in. It's a problem that's never solved. So if you're interested in problems, it's something you can keep going at from different angles. And the challenge and the interest is always there.
What's your process like as a writer? I mean, your day-to-day rituals and habits, how does it all come together to form the writer that you happen to be?
It does differ slightly according to whether I'm working on poems or prose. When I'm working on poems, it's usually a process of slow accretion. I'll be writing down little images and writing down little lines and seeing what they congeal into ultimately. With prose, I do sit down and I try to just power through it. I'm not a person who writes long word counts naturally. I'm not a person who's very who's very prolific in that sense. I like to work short. So it's a little bit different. But, you know, you wake up, you blast yourself with caffeine till you're practically poisoned with it. It's good to start your day off by reading and then making notes. That can really help and get you into the mindset. Stay off the freaking internet is the most important thing I can tell you. It will ruin your life. And it's really that. It's keeping yourself apart from the noise and just sort of setting yourself in a quiet space where something could happen.
And yet you've made such constructive use of the internet itself in one of its formats, the Twitter format, in your work. How do you separate yourself from that while also using it so profoundly?
The way I think of it is that on Twitter I'm talking to my friends. So when people talk about wasting time on Twitter, it's like, are you wasting time when you go out with your friends, drinking with them, sitting in a coffee shop with them? No, it's just written down. Your conversation's written down.
So but some people would argue that, yes, those are the kinds of distractions that
those tear people are psychos. We do not need to listen to those people at all. Those people are insane. No, you definitely need to have a life outside of these things. And this conversation is what spurs creativity. You know, cafes, that whole atmosphere. This is part of where this creativity comes from. If it's just you working on your own steam, eventually things get stale. You're breathing your own air.
Do you think Twitter is kind of a new cafe?
It is. It definitely is a cyber cafe. that you can just walk into anytime you want in like full hacker gear, sit down at your computer and be like, oh, let's do it.
Well, let's hear another one of your poems. We'll get to your new book in just a little while, but a slightly older poem, Government Spending. I thought it might be nice for people to hear a poem that isn't part of the smut metaphor genre.
There's no sex in this one. There's just the government. Government's not sexy. So yeah, let's do this. Government spending. The government spent a Patricia on me. A huge waste, it lamented, when we could have been spending it on another Nixon. The government spent all its beauty on the great light leap on the deer crossing sign. There was hardly any beauty left for anything else in America. And looking around them, the government said, is there none left? Print more. You are born. You barely contain yourself. You grow. Inside you, someone spends a billion to make prison more luxurious. Inside you, someone spends a billion to keep libraries open 1 hour later. Then, oh God, you feel wonderful. You must be on welfare. The government spent its whole education on me. At least, that is how it feels right now. I am bursting with educational dollars. I am bursting with other dollars as well. I'm rounded up. I'm one long row of O's. I get so many commas that the sentence doesn't stop. The dollars in me are a map of Missouri my mother can't fold back up. Oh no, the map is everywhere. But I know the way. I am hot on a trail. I am bursting with the dollars that put that knowing breath in drug dogs. All the spending of the space program is in me. The stars seem especially close. This is because they are a government handout. They are spending millions on moonlight research. When I am president, I will cut the arts and let my right arm flow downhill. I am ready. There is nothing trivial about me left. I am eliminating the penny every second. A dollar is peeled off a roll of thousands. It is the day. The mint of it is in my mouth. I open it, completely fresh.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Patricia Lockwood about her poetry, and she just read from a poem called Government Spending. Patricia, when did you decide to write that poem? When did you start it?
That was actually when I was living in my parents' house, when I was living at the rectory, which is before I moved to Lawrence, Kansas. And usually you're working with a title or with a phrase that has some ringing sound to you, which government spending had for me. And so I thought I would like to write a really lyrical poem. You know, not all of my poems have to have smut in them. I would say my entire first book is completely sex-free. So sometimes it's nice just to work in the music. You don't always have to be so gross.
I like that the phrase government spending has a music in it for you. Could you a lot of people, because of the content of those words, would not hear music in the sound of the words.
Well, part of it's the vowels. You have government spending. So you have these little echoes within it. But it's just part of the reason it becomes a buzzword is because it sounds good. I mean, part of the reason that people talk about government spending is because it's this very catchy little phrase. A lot of times you can turn those catchy little phrases to poetry as well.
So when you wrote that, what were some of the did you make any discoveries about your own thoughts about government spending by playing with the words themselves?
Well, I did discover that I didn't know anything about government. I had to do a lot of Googling, and I was like, what does the government spend on? And I kept bringing up that story about how people were pissed about the fruit fly studies that the government was doing and how they were so mad about that. So
remind us why people were mad about fruit fly studies.
I don't even remember, honestly. Why should we study the fly sex? I think that it was about fly sex, wasn't it? Yeah.
I honestly don't recall.
People get very concerned. I think that this was in the run-up to the election, the last presidential election. You know how certain things just get, they're a little bit catchy. They just get stuck in people's heads. They become a little bit viral. That was, the fruit fly study was that.
You were just mentioning that this is from before you necessarily incorporated smut into your work. And smut might be a little bit of an unfair term. term.
It's smutty. No, it's fair. It's totally fair.
Well, but do you consider that to be a crucial part of your identity as a poet, or are you going through a smutty phase, kind of like Picasso went through a blue phase?
Ah, my blue phase, my pink phase. I would not say that it's crucial. Like I said, my first book is fairly free of that. I think I talk about a vagina once, and that's all. But it's definitely not something that has to be in every poem. This book, Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexuals, that was clearly, it was the subject.
And that's your new book.
This is my new book.
So tell us the title again and tell us about this book.
It's a little bit tough. Actually, I have seen this title misspelled in more ways, including by my own press, than you could possibly imagine. It's Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexuals. Which, again, we're talking about things that have nice ring to them. That's a pretty sweet title right there, if I do say so.
What was the premise of this book?
Well, I was thinking a lot about questions of gender. I was thinking a lot about questions of sexuality. I was thinking about things like gay marriage panic, all those sorts of things. But, you know, when you say that you're thinking about those things, you're thinking about them in your wider life, and they make their way into your poetry. So it's not as if you set... You know, you don't sit down and decide to write a poem that has these themes, and you don't sit down and decide to write a book that is concentrating on this one subject.
Some people might do that.
Some people do.
What do you think is the difference between your approach to poetry and that one?
I think I'm much more instinctual. I know that people like to work on projects. A lot of these people are highly educated. You know, it might be a form that's more familiar to them to sit down with a thesis. But I really work as if I'm groping my way in the dark, you know, like grabbing boobs in a dark corridor as I go. And I prefer to work that way.
Could you read a selection from your new book? Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexuals?
That's right. It's actually, I brought along... a proof, and they've misspelled the title as Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexulas on the side.
Oh, no.
Like a sexual chocula type thing, which I thought was very funny. Revealing nature photographs. In a field, where else, you found a stack of revealing nature photographs.
We could air almost none of this poem due to explicit imagery. However, we were able to salvage a few gems for broadcast. Here they are.
The stack came up to your eye, you saw. Nature is big into blood play. Nature is into extreme age play. Nature does wild interracial. The pictures were so many they started to move. Let me watch for the rest of my natural life, you said, and sank down in the field and breathed hard. Let me watch and watch without her knowing. Let me see her where she can't see me. As long as she can't see me, I can breathe hard here forever. See nature do... See the shocking act that got her banned in 51 states, including Canada.
There is a lot of wordplay in that poem.
Quite a bit.
But at the same time, historically, maybe in more restrained times than ours, part of what poets often did was use double entendre to not mm-hmm. quite say what they were trying to say.
Absolutely.
And in a way... Although there is wordplay, which now sounds vaguely pornographic after hearing bloodplay and
right, yeah.
whatever. But what you aren't quite using language to hide what you're trying to say. In fact,
no.
It might be that you are doing totally the opposite.
Right.
Can you talk about that a little?
Part of what's going on with the language of porn and porn terminology is that it is really interesting. It is really interesting to interrogate that sort of thing. So on the one level, you are presenting it as poetic units of language, and then on another level, you're interrogating that.
With there is some exploration of gender in that poem, especially the man sort of causing nature to submit in some way.
Sure.
Do you think that being a woman writing with this kind of language, do you think that it would be different for a man to be using some of these very same turns of phrase?
I think that it could be, but we've also seen men do that, certainly. We've seen men working in this register, I think, you know, for a much longer time than we have seen women working in it.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, I mean, obviously, smutty and bawdy poems go back all the way. I mean, they go back to Catullus, Shakespeare. You know, I don't know where we get this idea that it's in the last 50 years that people suddenly started writing degenerate, smutty poems. It's been built in, I think, from the beginning.
What do you think about poetry kind of lends itself to that?
Because I think that these words sometimes come to us as received language. Euphemistic language, which is the language of sexuality and sexual and porn, you have already the euphemisms there. And euphemism is a huge part of what you're doing in poetry. So I think that it's very harmonious, actually.
Can you pick out a couple of phrases from that poem that you think you'd like to highlight to talk about this a little more, in a little more depth?
Sure. Oh, this is interesting. I can talk about this. The line, "See nature do untold animals sex." Those were all real terms. These were lines from actual porn spam emails. Sicko teen farm sex feast. What does that even mean? What kind of a farm is that? What is the feast you're having? Like, what's going on?
Well, that's funny because the subject lines from spam can be kind
very
of
poetic. Absolutely. People have, you know, gone to town on that entire deal because there's something about the remix of it. There's something about, like, the slight bot quality of spam, you know, this generated quality that can really end up poetic.
Talk a little bit about live readings because it seems like the environment at the live readings you do, first of all, like, what are the settings that you gravitate toward?
Well, it's, you know, there are lots of different places that you can do. You can be in a library, which I've done, or you can be literally in a pizza parlor, which I've also done, where people are shouting pizza orders above you and you're having to scream in order to read your poem above, like, the pizza nonsense that's happening. I like to read in slightly less formal places. I like to read in bars a lot. That's always fun. But really, each setting offers its own advantages. You know, a library might be slightly more formal, but it also is a place where people give you more of their attention. So you just kind of adjust yourself to the setting and, you know, you just figure out what particular audiences will respond best to in those places.
I want to get back to this in a second, but I've noticed that when you talk about what you're comfortable doing and what you prefer, you often say that you do this or you do that instead of I do this or I do that. Do you think that?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. That might just be diplomacy. I'm not sure.
Or a desire to not sit and talk about yourself for an hour?
Maybe so. I mean, I feel like I've been talking about myself a lot recently, and it's not, I am obviously very open about certain things, but I'm also very private, you know? So you do find ways to protect yourself. Maybe that's one of my ways.
I'm going to ask you a question that I think is kind of dreaded for a lot of writers.
Okay.
So I hate to do it, and I'm sorry if it causes any sort of, like, anxiety, but what are you working on now?
Oh, I am actually – no, this is an awesome question. I love to talk about it. I'm working on a memoir right now. When I moved back in with my parents, I thought this is so weird that the only way I can make it less weird is to write about this. So I started doing a little bit of a diary of, you know, living in the rectory with my priest dad and my crazy mom. And then after a while, it seemed to sort of take shape into a book, and I just recently sold that, which was really exciting.
As you approach this memoir writing, do you have role models who you think about following their example to some extent? Or who would you think are your role models when you explore how to write a memoir?
I continue to read a lot of really good memoirs that have been formative for me. You have Speak Memory by Nabokov. You have Annie Dillard's An American Childhood. These are all, you know, examples of the sort of thing that are these very focused, beautiful, lapidary memoirs. And then you have people who have written comedic memoirs, people like Haven Camel and that sort of thing. So I have, on the one hand, I have these very, very super poetic, lyrical memoirs that I'm reading. And then on the other one, just, like, balls out funny stuff. So we're trying to work, you know, a little bit of a line between the two.
As you say, balls out funny
balls
stuff.
Balls out funny stuff.
I find that choice of phrasing funny. And I also think about that earlier in the show you were talking about that maybe we've seen men in this role of being explicit with language a little
right.
more and body. But what about the role of men being just funny, period? Are we more used to men kind of clowning around than
peacocking?
We are?
Peacocking. I think that maybe we are. But I also think that history and the timeline and the canon have sort of a way of, like, smoothing out these contributions from women. So we'll have a lot of women who are famous in their own day for these things, and then it's gradually eroded, you know, as we go on and people forget about them. And I think that with each new generation, you sort of have to rediscover this and address this question. It's like the women are always there doing this. It's just that we forget about them.
Who do you think are the other women in your own generation doing this?
Oh, we have lots of funny ladies. I mean, I honestly read Tina Fey and Mindy Kaling's books a bunch, and I think that those are just honestly really excellent books, very well written. And I think sometimes when it comes to that sort of a comic book, people don't pay as much attention to the craft. But those are very well-crafted books. You can learn a lot from them.
We have time for you to read just one more very short poem, if you have a short poem, out of your new book, Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexuals.
Bambi is fresh from the countryside. Bambi is fresh, and we want him on film. He doesn't even know how to kiss yet. Lean in and part your lips, we tell him, and pull a slow strip off a tree. We shine our biggest spotlight on him. Our biggest spotlight is the sun. And under the spotlight, the deer drips sweat. And what do deer like more than salt? Now look at the fawn and grow an antler, we patiently instruct him. It will grow from your thoughts, like the ones on your head. Oh, Bambi, says the fawn. Oh, Bambi. Fresh grass stains around the young mouth. Every deer gets called Bambi at least once in its life. Every deer must answer to Bambi. Every deer hears, don't kill Bambi. Every deer hears, don't eat Bambi. Every deer hears, look, oh look, it's Bambi. When the deer all die, they will die of genericide, of one baby name for the million of them. Then women begin to be called Bambi, and then deer understand what women are like. Light shafts of long blonde hair and long legs. The sun piercing through the Bavarian trees, and the sun touching down on the dewy green ground. Then women begin to be called fawn, and then women begin to say, Bambi, oh Bambi. And their mouths are open, and they gape like a mouth when it takes a big bite of spring green. The spotlight shines down through the trees and long legs. This is the first movie most of us see. Small name for a small deer, Bambi. Sometimes he feels all the deer could fit inside him. The movie we are making is this one. All the deer and one deer, one after another. Subtitles, so we know what his soft sounds are saying. Mostly he says, the meadow, the meadow! Like the women who are Bambi say, God, oh God. What they mean is a wide open space, a great clearing. All the deer and us watching in a great open field. A great wide clearing in the face of the deer says, the meadow, and all of us watching. The deer's mouths moving as if they are reading. But no, they are eating the grass.
Thanks so much, Patricia.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Lawrence poet Patricia Lockwood. You can hear the poems she read today in their entirety at kcur.org. Libraries have long been places where new technologies can be seen and experienced for the first time. In the 80s, it was the laser printer. In the 90s, the World Wide Web. Now, 3D printers are becoming increasingly available in libraries throughout the country. Esther Honig recently visited the Johnson County Public Library to see how people are using this new device.
It's a Monday night at the Johnson County Library in Overland Park. And beyond the shelves of books and the rows of computers sits the makerspace. A small room filled with the library's newest tech gadgets, including the 3D printer.
In the beginning, we really weren't sure what people were going to use it for, but it's proven itself quite well, so we get a lot of use out of it.
That's Meredith Nelson, maker librarian and the woman behind the development of the makerspace. These are her open hours, and she's about to help a visitor who's printing for the first time.
My name is Elizabeth Applebaum.
Okay. Elizabeth Applebaum is a retired math teacher. She's printing a 3D cone for teaching students in pre-calculus.
Well, let's step over here and I can show you how to do that.
Nelson downloads the file from a popular site for 3D design called Thingiverse, and she fills out a form.
Once it's submitted, it's in, and it'll go on the end of our queue. So, and then we'll give you a call when it's ready to pick up.
I mean, that's all there is to, all I have to do?
That's all you gotta do.
Oh, that's amazing.
Like all services in the library, this is free. And Nelson says they even bought a second printer to keep up with increasing demand. The printers themselves cost between $2,000 to $3,000, but they're inexpensive to maintain. The best part, says Nelson, is seeing the designs that people come up with.
Especially from kids who come in and make their own Lego attachments and their own Lego toys. It's really cool to see them actually working the 3D software and printing stuff like that, because for them, they're really learning hands-on. And okay, so they're making toys, but big deal. They're, you know, nine.
The 3D printers are also used by local artists and inventors to make prototypes, or by older professionals who want to beef up their job skills. People have even printed prosthetic hands for those with a physical disability. This is all part of a larger push to make libraries a hub for innovation and creation.
The whole makerspace movement in libraries shows the transformation that is taking place in libraries across the country.
Barbara Stripling is president of the American Library Association. She's been watching as more and more libraries adopt sophisticated technology like the 3D printer.
It is enabling libraries to transform their relationship with communities and to empower community members of all ages across the country to be creators of information, not just consumers.
At this point, most larger cities have at least one library housing a 3D printer, which means that even as this technology is still maturing, we have the ability to test it out and learn how to use it. Because as most experts will tell you, soon 3D printers will be as common a technology as the personal computer. In fact, 20 years from now, some of us might think back to our public library and make the same observation as Barbara Stripling.
It was my first time to see a 3D printer. I'd never even seen one before.
The Makerspace is open during the same hours as the Johnson County Library. But if you want the chance to try out the 3D printing software, stop by for their open hours on Monday evenings. For KCUR, I'm Esther Honig.
It's time to wrap up today's show, but if you'd like to hear this conversation again, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard later in the day. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Tomorrow, we'll check in on our Beyond Our Borders series to hear about the Skerrit Renaissance neighborhood in the Old Northeast. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.